$1,000 spent on advertising, he'd set it an awful lot. "Would either of you like any coffee?" asked Dobson.
"No, thanks," Valerie and I answered in unison.
"All right, then. Let me start by telling you what I told Jeffrey," Dobson said, pointing to Crespin in his charcoal-gray suit. "The president has no knowledge of this meeting. If he did, it would never be happening. Instead, Ian would be in the press room telling the world everything about Operation Truth Seeker, or whatever stupid name this damn thing probably had."
Seamlessly, Ian Landry chimed in.
"The president would sooner sacrifice a second term than try to sweep something like this under the rug."
"And trust me, that's not hyperbole," said Dobson. "Unfortunately, though, this is about more than just favorability ratings and politics. This is about national security, and Frank Karcher has seriously threatened it."
I listened very carefully to what came next.
Dobson explained the protocol of what happens after the death of active CIA personnel, especially someone on Karcher's level as the National Clandestine Service Chief. Basically, anything and everything having to do with his life gets searched, reviewed, raked over, and then raked over again. "The problem in this case," said Dobson, "is that it's like having the fox guard the henhouse. We don't know how deep this runs at the CIA, who is involved and how many. But if the guy shooting at you from that rooftop yesterday is any indication, it doesn't bode well."
"He's an agent with the Special Activities Division, Karcher's former unit within the CIA," explained Crespin.
"Then, of course, there's the young man at the center of all this."
Dobson looked down at an open file as if searching his notes for Owen's name.
"Yes, Owen Lewis," he said, "who, as of right now, is nowhere to be found."
"Damn, Skippy. Nowhere to be found. Where the hell are you, Owen? And what's with the secret fishing expedition? You're up to something, but what?"
I waited for Dobson to look at me in light of his mentioning Owen, but he didn't. Instead, he reached for another file on his desk, this one featuring a bright red stripe across it. "But back to Karcher and the issue of national security," he continued. "I'm pretty sure I could lose my job, if not worse, for what I'm about to share with you. But since that's the least of my problems this morning, we'll be making an exception."
He paused to take a sip of coffee, staring at us over the lip of the mug, first at Valerie, then at me.
"Besides, according to Crespin here, if it weren't for the two of you, things could have been a lot worse."
And with that, Dobson opened the file. Chapter 106. The first thing he held up was a color photograph, measuring roughly 8x10. It could have been a headshot for a leading man, albeit one more suited for Bollywood than Hollywood. "This is Dr. Prajit Sengupta," said Dobson, his exaggerated diction suggesting just a trace of xenophobia. He then read from the file in bullet point fashion. "Born in India, educated here in the States, Stanford undergrad, Harvard Medical School. Currently a staff neuroscientist with a New Frontier Medical Institute in Bethesda, specializing in ionotropic and metabotropic receptor manipulation in the human brain."
Dobson paused, looked up. "If anyone knows what that actually means, be my guest."
I didn't. Not exactly. Still, it wasn't hard to see where this was heading.
Sure enough, according to Dobson, Prajit Sengupta was the missing link to the serum, the guy Karcher had used to turn Owen's research into an injectable polygraph machine. One question, though, and I didn't hesitate with it.
"How do you know this?" I interrupted.
Dobson nodded slightly, as if he'd expected me to ask that. "Again, this isn't for broadcast, but before the CIA could do its reconnaissance on Karcher's apartment, including his hard drive, I got in there first."
He corrected himself with a raised palm.
"Not me, personally, but a special investigator with the FBI, working unofficially, of course." All the while, Dobson was still holding up the picture of Sengupta. It was a posed photograph, most likely taken on behalf of the medical institute where the doctor worked. I could picture the website, complete with a glowing bio underneath his good looks and warm smile. Nowhere would his moonlighting efforts be mentioned. Then, poof, he was gone. Dobson lowered the photo, only to lift another one from the file. Exhibit B, apparently. "Now meet Arash Ghassemi," he said.
The only thing the two pictures had in common was the size. Instead of a posed headshot, this one was courtesy of a zoom lens from an angle that suggested the photographer was somewhere in the Middle East he really shouldn't have been. Black and white and a bit grainy, it was still clear enough to tell that Ghassemi was the opposite of Sengupta in the looks department. More to the point, Ghassemi had pretty much been hit by the ugly stick, repeatedly. Again, Dobson read from the file. Born in Iran, educated in the States, Stanford undergrad, MIT graduate program, nuclear science and engineering. Then days after accepting a job with General Atomics in San Diego, he suddenly split town and returned to Iran. The subtext of that last sentence was crystal clear. Arash Ghassemi was now working for the Iranian nuclear program. Less clear was whether it was by choice. And even less clear than that was what this Iranian nuclear engineer had to do with Sengupta, the Indian neuroscientist. Until I replayed Dobson's description of the two in my head, word for word. And the one word, the one school, he'd mentioned twice. Stanford, I said.
Very good, Mr. Mann. You win the Samsonite luggage, said Dobson. You see, this is a tale of two roommates.
Chapter 107. He had it all right there in the file, right down to the actual dorm where they first met freshman year. Arroyo House in Wilbur Hall. Prajit Sengupta and Arash Ghassemi had become fast friends at Stanford. Put them most anywhere else in the world and they had little in common. Under the bright glare of a California sun, however, they might as well have been brothers. Two strangers thrown together in a strange land. By sophomore year, they'd become roommates, all but inseparable, including rushing Sigma Chi together. And if you're looking for a reason why Ghassemi trusted Sengupta so much, even 20 years later, look no further than that fraternity, said Dobson. The handsome and more gregarious Sengupta had been tapped to pledge, but Ghassemi had been passed over. That is, until Sengupta made it very clear that they were a package deal. Sigma Chi couldn't get one without the other. Of course, who the hell was some pledge to be making a demand like that? A pretty damn clever one, said Dobson. In true frat boy fashion, Sengupta challenged the rush chair to a drinking contest, shot for shot, last man standing. If Sengupta won, Ghassemi could become a brother, and if he lost, that was the clever part. The rush chair outweighed the skinny kid from Bangalore by nearly 100 pounds. It wasn't a fair fight. How could he ever lose? But he did. Dobson smiled. Like I said, it wasn't a fair fight. Sengupta, who was pre-med at the time, had injected himself with a derivative of a drug called iomazonil. Apparently it binds the alcohol receptors in the brain. In other words, it's a binge drinker's dream come true. Dobson pointed at me. Okay, now this is where you ask me that question again, Mr. Mann. How do I know this?
For sure, I was about to. Not Valerie, though. She'd been around the block a few times in the world of intelligence gathering. All she could do was sigh in a way that had only one translation. We live in a very complicated world. CIA or NIA? She asked Dobson.
Both, he answered.
Then he explained. Not long after Ghassemi returned to Iran, against his will, to work for the Iranian nuclear program, Sengupta was recruited by the National Investigation Agency of India, the NIA. This was at the urging of the CIA, based on the greatest shared interest the U.S. and India have as two nuclear powers, making sure Iran doesn't become one as well. Sengupta knew that his good friend Ghassemi was miserable back in his homeland of Iran, Dobson continued. Iranians might despise what they see as U.S. hegemony, but they do so having never spent time in this country. But Ghassemi had. We weren't the enemy.
I listened to Dobson, almost dizzy.
It was hard enough to keep track of the names, let alone the motives and inferences. Valerie might have had the pole position, but I was finally up to speed. Ghassemi was giving Sengupta, his good friend and former roommate, Iranian nuclear secrets. Dobson took another sip of coffee before leaning forward, his words coming slowly.
I understand you've lost someone very close to you, Mr. Mann, and that undoubtedly you want justice.
I sure would.
But I'm afraid justice means exposing Sengupta. and that would mean no more connection with Ghassemi. Thanks to that relationship, our government currently knows more about the Iranian nuclear program than the Supreme Leader himself. And I wish it were hyperbole when I say that the fate of the world could very well depend on that relationship continuing.
Yes, indeed. We live in a very complicated world. I wasn't sure what I was going to say, only that it was something. Perhaps a feeble attempt to strike some sort of justice bargain, the way I used to with prosecutors after I went to the dark side, as Claire liked to call it, and became a defense attorney. But before I could even push out the first word, the door of Dobson's office opened. It was his secretary.
"I'm sorry to interrupt, but there's..."
Dobson cut her off.
"I said no calls, Marcy."
"I know, but it's not for you. It's for Mr. Mann," she said. "Apparently it's an emergency. Someone named Winston Smith?" That got everyone staring at me. Although with Dobson, it was more like glaring. If looks could kill.
"No one outside this room is supposed to know you're here, Mr. Mann," he said.
Immediately, Crespin cleared his throat. Maybe he could just sense it, that something was up and I desperately needed a lifeline. Or maybe it was more than a sense. Perhaps he, too, had read 1984.
"Sorry, Clay, my bad," said Crespin. "Mr. Mann's sister is being operated on this morning, and that's his nephew calling to let him know how it went. For obvious reasons, Mr. Mann ditched his cell phone once this whole ordeal started."
I watched and listened to Crespin with nothing short of amazement. He was so calm, so convincing. The guy could probably fool a polygraph if he had to. He had to be the best liar I'd ever met. Actually, make that the second best. Dobson nodded to his secretary.
"Put it through."
As she disappeared back to her desk, he handed me his phone. The longest 2 seconds of my life followed as I waited for the call to be transferred. Click.
"Winston, is that you?"
I asked.
"Yes, it's me," said Owen. "And what Dobson just told you is bullshit."
Chapter 108. The questions were bouncing around in my head so fast and deliriously I could feel my brain smushed up against my skull just trying to contain them all. Where has Owen been? How did he know I was in Dobson's office, let alone what was being said? And who's the new friend he went on to mention, the one he wants me to meet? The only thing close to an answer, or better yet, what would get me closer to all the answers, was the address Owen gave me before hanging up. But not before first telling me I had to come alone.
"For real, Trevor, I mean it. Just you."
Of course, that went over like a fart in an elevator with Valerie and Crespin, especially Crespin. He and his spidey sense had bailed me out in Dobson's office, and this was how I repaid him?
"I'm off to go meet the kid, but you can't come?"
"I'll be back, I promise," I said, "and I'll do everything I can to have Owen with me." It was either detain me or let me go. They let me go. Almost 1 hour to the dot after saying goodbye on the phone in Dobson's office to my nephew, Winston Smith, I arrived at 15th Street Northwest in Madison Drive. If the Jeopardy category is well-known Washington addresses, I'll admit that I tap out with 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Besides, who really needs to know the address of the Washington Monument? All you have to do is look up, right?
"Father, I cannot tell a lie,"
came a voice over my shoulder. I turned to see Owen, smiling at his own cleverness about the line and our location, although I knew he hadn't chosen it for the irony. Just because I thought I'd come alone didn't mean I actually had. The flat, sprawling grounds of the Washington Monument, with nothing but a circle of skinny flagpoles for cover, were his way of making sure that even if I had been followed, no one was within earshot. Speaking of hearing things on the sly, Owen pivoted to his right.
"Trevor, I'd like you to meet Lawrence Bass," he said.
I pushed aside what was now the latest question in the long queue. How the hell did these two ever meet up? And shook the man's hand. I knew exactly who Bass was, namely because of what he wasn't, the next director of the CIA. Owen and I had watched him withdraw his name on television, standing in the East Room, flanked lovingly by his wife and 2 young daughters. We'd listened to him explain that he wanted to spend more time with his family, and we'd both known he was lying. "Wait a minute," I said, turning back to Owen. "Gone fishing? Lawrence Bass? This is where you went?"
No one just walks away from being named CIA director, Owen said. There had to be more to it. Not that I was really expecting Lawrence to divulge anything, but as it turns out, he was doing some fishing of his own. True to his military background, Bass took the cue and didn't dilly-dally. Nor was there much emotion. The guy seemed to have everything wrapped in a blanket of calm and measured. Last week I paid a visit to Clay Dobson in his office, he said, and I never really left. With that, Bass reached into his pocket and held out an iPhone. I recognized the app he tapped. It was the same one Claire always used to edit and organize her interviews, Voice Recorder HD. Let the answers begin. Chapter 109. Owen didn't bother saying the actual words. That would have been redundant. One glance at him, the look on his face, was all it took. What did I tell you, dude? All I could see in my mind was the picture of Dr. Whitmer and his good old college chum, Clay Dobson. And all I could hear now was Dobson's voice telling someone in his office that Whitmer should have been killed sooner. Of course, that someone was Frank Karcher, or Karch, as Dobson kept calling him in between rounds of cursing him out. For two guys in cahoots with each other, they sure weren't seeing eye to eye on much. Cover-ups are a bitch. Jesus, I said. How? Well, I was the director of intelligence programs with the NSC, said Bass, who somehow managed to convey that without a hint of bravado. It was merely fact. Same for the way he claimed he'd been able to hide the bug in Dobson's office. I just dropped it in his pencil holder when he wasn't looking. Bass fell silent again so I could keep listening. But all I had were more and more questions. What about Landry? I asked. Was the press secretary involved as well? Best we can tell, no, said Owen. There's at least a half dozen times when the two are alone in Dobson's office together and nothing ever comes up. Anybody else? Just Prajit Sengupta, said Owen. The Indian doctor? I thought you told me that was all bullshit. Not all of it. Like with any lie, there's always a bit of truth. Sengupta exists. He's a real person, said Owen. Come to think of it, the Iranian guy from Stanford is real too. I clearly didn't follow. Bass paused the recording, his thumb shifting to another file. He pressed play. For the next minute, with the flags around the monument whipping in the wind above us, I listened to Dobson on the phone with Sengupta, asking about his friends in college, specifically if there was anyone from the Middle East. Sengupta was Dobson's man for the serum, botched as it was, said Owen. Turns out, Sengupta has a brother back in India doing 20 years for drug trafficking. Or at least, he was, until Dobson intervened with Indian intelligence officials. The serum, in exchange for time served. The brother's now a free man. So Dobson discovers an Iranian roommate and invents the story about him, I said. Yeah, and of all things, the guy, Ghassemi, actually did go back to Iran. According to Stanford alumni records, he owns a software company in Tehran. But of course, that wouldn't prevent him from moonlighting for the nuclear program, right? Dobson had all the angles covered, said Owen. He then turned to Bass. Except one. Bass raised his palms as if to deflect the credit. I knew nothing about this serum, but I couldn't shake the feeling that something was up, especially when I heard Karcher's name to replace me. You were right. Hell, you were both right, I said, giving Owen his due. So why didn't they look happier about it? Or even happy at all? That was when I realized what they had already figured out. And to think, I was the only one with the law degree. Chapter 110. Damn, I muttered. Owen nodded. Yep. The recordings. They're inadmissible. Not only that, they're illegal, I said. Owen nodded again. Yep. I don't care, said Bass. He really doesn't, said Owen. Believe me, I've tried to talk him out of it. Out of what? I asked. Bass shrugged. So maybe I risk doing a little time. It will be worth it to implicate Dobson. And once the investigation starts, something else will have to turn up, he said. The truth will come out. I had every intention of making a great counter-argument, beginning with the reason why Owen hadn't wanted to go public in the first place. He wanted Dobson dead to rights. We both did now. But I'd just come from the guy's office,
where I'd seen up close and personal Dobson's ability to construct an alternate reality. Dobson was good at it. Too good. Without the recordings from his office, the odds of his seeing the inside of a jail cell were anything but a sure thing. He'd be ruined politically, but he'd probably still go free. Yeah, that was the argument I was about to make, point by point. Instead, all I could do was listen to the echo of Bass's last sentence in my head. "The truth will come out," he said. "The truth will come out." I turned to Owen. "You still have the notebook from the lab, right?" It took him a second to figure out what I was asking, but only a second. The kid was a genius, after all. And when I saw him smile, it was suddenly as if he could hear the same echo. "I'd say 3 days, two if I don't sleep," he answered. "But then what? How?" I reached into my pocket. Never had a prepaid cell phone been put to better use. "Yes, operator, could I please have the main number for the New York Times?" Sebastian Cole couldn't take my call fast enough. "Jesus Christ, you're alive," he said. "I was starting to wonder." "You and me both," I said. "But yes, I'm alive, very much so. Now, do you remember that envelope I gave you? The one you were only supposed to open if I wasn't?" "Are you kidding me?" said Sebastian. "I've been staring at it every day since you left. I was planning to kill you myself just so I could open it." "I'll save you the time," I said. "Go ahead, open it." "Are you serious?" "As the Queen Mother," I said. "And as you read what's inside, I want you to keep one thing in mind." "What's that?" "You ain't seen nothing yet." Chapter 111. Inside the White House, dead presidents are nothing more than old paintings. The real currency is the almighty favor. And I'd just done a big one for the Morris administration. "Thank you again, Trevor, for making this happen," said Dobson. He had left the West Wing for the Westin and Sebastian Cole's corner suite, where I greeted him at the door with a firm handshake and the assurance that this, as in this meeting and what it was in exchange for, was in everyone's best interests. The deal I'd brokered was simple. I told Dobson that I'd already gone to Sebastian at the New York Times with the recordings of the serum being used at the black site in Stare Kikute. But a lot had changed since that visit. Most of all, the revelation by Dobson that the CIA had a mole in the Iranian nuclear program who stood to be exposed. With Karcher now dead and his draconian operation disbanded, there was a choice to be made. A bombshell of a story for the Times versus our country knowing whether Iran had the bomb. What was an American patriot to do? Convince the Times editor to stand down, that was what. And in return, Sebastian got unfettered access to the president and his full cooperation for an unprecedented series of in-depth interviews culminating in a book detailing his first term in office. Guaranteed bestseller on the Times list itself. Number one with a bullet. This meeting was simply to iron out the details. "Can I get you something to drink?" I asked. I pointed over at a credenza. "They just brought up some fresh coffee if you want." Of course he wanted it. Death, taxes, and Dobson chugging caffeine. "Sure," he said. "Black, no sugar." Right on cue, Sebastian came over to shake hands, launching immediately into a conversation with Dobson about the last time they'd seen each other. It was last year's White House Correspondents' Dinner, just a few months after President Morris took office. Jimmy Fallon was hilarious. "I thought the president was in good form too," said Sebastian, or something like that. Whatever it took to keep Dobson occupied. "Here you go," I said, returning moments later with the coffee. "Black, no sugar." Dobson took a sip. He shot a glance at the mug. "I know it's a little strong, isn't it?" I said. "Too strong?" Which was like asking a guy if your handshake was too strong. What's he going to say? "No, not at all," he said. "It's good."
"Good," said Sebastian. "Shall we sit down?"
He led the way over to the hotel's modernist take on a living room area. One couch opposite two armchairs, a black lacquered table in the middle. There were no place cards, but once Sebastian sat down in one of the armchairs, it was only natural that Dobson would take the couch. Better yet, he sat right in the center. Center stage, if you will. "Nice room," said Dobson, looking around.
You should see the other one, dude. Or at least, that was what I pictured Owen saying through the wall while watching on his laptop. The kid really had a thing for adjoining rooms.
Chapter 112. From the other armchair, I watched and listened as Dobson laid out in detail the ways in which Sebastian would be able not only to conduct the one-on-one interviews with the president, but also to travel with him once he began his re-election campaign.
Not the press bus, Cole, said Dobson. I mean shotgun, right there next to the man. We're talking the kind of access that would make Bob Woodward shit his pants with jealousy.
Sebastian smiled and nodded. In fact, that was pretty much all he allowed himself, as he deftly used the cover of his proper British upbringing to come off as agreeable as possible. Owen had made it very clear. Faster than aspirin, but slower than eye drops.
Clay, do you want some more coffee? I asked.
5 minutes in, and I'd already poured him one refill. Dobson shook me off.
No, I'm all set, he said.
We'll see about that, I so wanted to say. Instead, I simply peeked at my watch and shot a glance over at Sebastian. Finally, and once and for all, it was time to hear the truth.
So, any questions so far?
Dobson soon asked. It was clear he was only being polite. This was the end of the bargain, the quid to Sebastian's quo, and he was sure he'd delivered in spades. And in fact, he had. Desperate men know no boundaries. Sebastian sat back in his armchair, folded his legs, and used the few seconds of complete silence that followed to make it very clear that yes, he actually did have some questions.
Have you ever told a lie? He asked.
Dobson's reaction was as expected, his eyes narrowing to an incredulous squint.
What kind of a question is that?
A rather simple one, said Sebastian.
Dobson looked at me for help with this suddenly crazy British journalist for the New York Times. I was the broker of this deal, after all. But I was also a former prosecutor.
Had you ever met Claire Parker? I asked.
What?
Said Dobson.
Who?
Did you not hear me, or do you not know the name?
I know the... I mean, I know who she is.
You mean was, right? You're aware that she was murdered in Manhattan a little over a week ago, aren't you?
I watched as Dobson looked over my shoulder at the door. It was his way out. Escape. Freedom. From what, exactly, he wasn't sure yet. But it couldn't be good. That is, for a lesser man. And in that moment, right there, a lifetime of ego and arrogance, of Dobson always thinking he was the smartest guy in the room, did exactly what we thought it would. It kept his ass seated square on that couch. Complete and utter inertia.
Yes, it was all over the news, he said calmly. Claire Parker, the writer for the Times, was shot to death in the back of a taxi.
Do you know why she was murdered? I asked.
It was reported as a robbery, said Dobson.
Do you think that's what it was?
Why wouldn't it be?
The smug expression, the self-satisfaction. He looked like a kid who just figured out a board game without reading the rules.
I don't know, you tell me, I said. Do you know why she was really murdered?
Dobson opened his mouth to answer, but it was as if the hinges of his jaw had suddenly jammed. Every muscle in his face and neck snapped to attention, as if somewhere in his brain a switch had been flipped. And indeed it had.
No,
he managed to push past his lips. But as soon as he did, it was as if the word had turned around and punched his lights out, his head jolting back, and his legs shaking as if the couch had just become an electric chair. His eyes darted to the table in front of him, the coffee table. He stared at his cup, the realization sinking in. He couldn't believe it. He didn't want to believe it. But he had no choice. He was getting the ultimate taste of his own medicine, and it was going down hard. So was he. Chapter 113. Did you instruct Frank Karcher to have Claire Parker killed? I asked, and immediately repeated the question, full-throated, over the sound of Dobson desperately trying to fight against the pain.
Did you instruct Frank Karcher to have Claire Parker killed?
Even if he wanted to leave now, he couldn't. His body wouldn't let him.
but he also had no intention of answering. Forget every word. It was every syllable that had become a struggle. And yet he somehow managed to string two together after sucking in a gasp of air.
Fuck you! He bellowed.
From the corner of my eye, I saw the flat screen against the wall light up. Dobson turned to look, only to realize he was looking at a live feed of himself. Feeling pain was one thing. Watching yourself feeling it added a whole new component. Owen was playing for keeps. We all were. Fuck you back, Dobson. Have you forgotten how your serum works? Only this wasn't his serum. This was the one he'd wished he'd had from the start. The one that didn't kill people, even if they were being honest. Better yet, it didn't need to be injected. It could be absorbed into the bloodstream without being compromised by stomach acids. The only thing Owen couldn't do was make it tasteless. But strong black coffee was a pretty good masking agent. I leaned forward, staring into Dobson's eyes, which had turned red from burst blood vessels. He looked like a demon. The only thing that will stop the pain is telling the truth, I said. But as I looked at him, his body convulsing so violently it felt as if the entire room were shaking, I realized we both knew that wasn't true. There was something else that could stop the pain. Sebastian looked over at me, worried. I could read his face. Is Dobson that deranged? Is he crazy enough to do it? I shook my head, but it was too late. Dobson had seen Sebastian. And of all things, as his eyes began to leak with red tears, his fists balled so tight I thought they would both snap off at the wrists, he did something that for the first time made me think that, yeah, maybe he was that sick in the head. He smiled. I turned away, only to see him again on the television, the smile seemingly wider. He wanted us to know, if I'm going down, I'm taking you all with me. No, he was bluffing. I was sure of it. Sebastian, on the other hand, wasn't. He was more than looking at me now. He was pleading. Do it, he said. Please. I put my hand in my pocket, feeling for the cylinder. I knew it was there. I must have checked it 20 times before Dobson arrived, but I had no intention of taking it out, let alone using it. Do it, Sebastian repeated. He was scared to death. Or more specifically, scared of the murder charge that would be slapped on all of us. In the cylinder was the antidote. A small syringe with a spring-loaded needle and the ability to negate the effects of the serum in a matter of seconds. Just in case, Owen had said. As in, just in case Dobson would sooner die than confess. But I wasn't having it. Or maybe I was simply too angry, too consumed by the desire to see him own up to what he'd done. Suddenly I heard the door flung open behind me, the sound of Owen bursting into the room. As fast as he was moving, he managed to keep his voice calm. Trevor, he said. Just my name. That and all the subtext that went with it. Are you sure you know what you're doing? And for the first time since this whole nightmare had started, I was. I stood and walked slowly over to Dobson, sitting on the coffee table directly in front of him. There would be no more yelling from me, no more demanding that he come clean. He simply needed to know that I was fine with his decision either way. He had everything to lose, and I had nothing. She was pregnant, I told him. She was pregnant with my child. And with that, I stood up and walked out of frame. The choice was his now, and only his. Truth or die? Epilogue. Chapter 114. In the world of newspapers, the term is shirt tale, a short and related story that's added to the end of a longer one. Of course, I only know that because of Claire. She was my go-to for journalistic lingo, and I was hers for all things legal. Between the two of us, we always had a leg up on the Sunday crossword. Suffice it to say, Dobson's confession was all the rage for a couple of weeks, all the more so given how it was obtained. But that was the whole point, wasn't it? Owen never denied that the serum had the potential to foil a terrorist plot that could kill hundreds, if not thousands or more. The question was, who got to decide whether or not we used it?
So let the public debate begin, because that's how a democracy is supposed to work. In the words of Lincoln at Gettysburg, government of the people, by the people, for the people. It was only fitting, then, that Owen gave the recording of Dobson to the D.C. police, the FBI, and the entire world via the internet, all at the same time. First, though, he gave a private screening to Agent Valerie Jensen and Jeffrey Crespin. That was the first of a few deals I negotiated. Ethics and morality exist on an ever-shifting scale. The trick, I thought, was keeping perspective. Somewhere along the line, there always needed to be a clearly established definition of right and wrong, black and white. As long as you had that, you could proceed to deal with the gray areas. At least, that was what I used to teach my students at Columbia Law. But then this past summer happened. I don't teach them that anymore. Look around you, Mr. Mann, said Crespin. It's all gray. Which would explain why he was ultimately fine with my other two deals. They needed his approval. One was regarding Josiah Brennan. Jesus himself could have returned to defend Brennan in court for money laundering, but there was still no way he could avoid jail time entirely. That is, if the NSA chose to cooperate with law enforcement and pursue charges against him. All I could picture, though, was Brennan's 9-year-old daughter, Rebecca, getting frisked every time she went to visit him behind bars. The same Rebecca who could have easily ratted out Valerie and me in her father's office. So I had a different suggestion, and Crespin went for it. It was time for Brennan to launder some of his own money. Detective Dave Lamont didn't have a 9-year-old daughter, but he did have 3 teenage sons with his wife Joni. They also had a mortgage, school tuitions, and orthodontist bills. NYPD death benefits only go so far. His additional life insurance policy, even less far. So Brennan was charged with something else instead. Looking after the Lamont family financially. Also setting up a special IRA for Lamont's partner, McGeary. Was it a rich man buying his freedom? Maybe, if he'd thought of it first. But he didn't. Money doesn't always have to be the root of all evil. Which was the same rationale I used regarding Shahid Aldasari, the other deal that needed Crespin's consent. Personally, I didn't care one way or the other what the NSA wanted to do with him. He had skedaddled back to Saudi Arabia the split second Dobson was arrested, and the fact that he wasn't a U.S. citizen presented a far more complicated legal challenge, especially given his wealth and influence. But there it was again. Wealth and influence. Might as well put it to good use, I told Crespin. Just what do you have in mind? He asked. It was actually what Owen had originally had in mind. Chapter 115. I thought I was curing Alzheimer's. That was what he'd told me from the start. Now maybe he will. Of course, I couldn't really blame Aldasari for making a counteroffer to the strongly suggested contribution to Owen's newly founded research facility. $20 million is a lot of money, after all, even for a Saudi banker. Then again, everything is relative. Assuming he was able to fight extradition and avoid trial in the States, he'd still be the Roman Polanski of poker and gambling here. No more trips to Vegas. No more trips anywhere in the United States, his favorite place to be. In the end, Aldasari figured that was an even greater price to pay. God bless America. And Godspeed to Owen. I've got my work cut out for me, he said when the facility officially opened in the fall. Well then, I said, you better get busy, dude. For good measure, I rubbed my hands together as if doing a bit of his dry wash routine. You meet a lot of people in your lifetime, many of whom will have an immeasurable impact on you. Then there are those who literally change who you are. You can generally count those people on one hand. And fittingly, Owen Lewis will always be one of them. In the wake of everything that happened, all the sadness and despair and mayhem, he managed to give me something I would have never thought possible. Optimism. Crazy to think, I still can't even buy the kid a drink. So that was that. All the deals I'd cut after Dobson's confession. As for the one made before it, I'm fairly certain Sebastian has no regrets. In fact, I'm positive of it. Sebastian Cole may be the last journalist on Earth whom President Morris, with his 21% approval rating, will actually grant an interview to. But Sebastian's first-hand account of what happened in that hotel room, including a very revealing Q&A with Dobson while he was under the influence of the serum, gave him the scoop of a lifetime. Throw in the exclusive interviews Owen and I guaranteed him in return for his cooperation, and Sebastian all but owned the front page of the Times for an entire month. But the best part, at least for me, was the class he displayed throughout it all. The byline of every article he wrote covering the story read the same, by Claire Parker and Sebastian Cole. "You're a far better man than I first gave you credit for," I told him. "Likewise," he said. It's been moments like that when I've missed Claire the most. That's when I usually hop in my car and make the drive up to Wellesley, west of Boston, and the Woodlawn Cemetery, where all Parkers have been buried for over a century. Only once, though, have I fallen into the cliché of talking to her tombstone. She would have laughed at the sight of that. And who knows, maybe somewhere she is laughing, and doing that little crinkle thing with her nose that in a weird and wonderful way always made her look even prettier. I know that as time goes on, those trips to her gravesite will happen less often. But not because I'll miss her less. No, eventually what will happen, maybe amid a gust of wind through the branches of a nearby northern red oak, is that I'll hear that tombstone of hers talk back to me. "It's okay, Trevor," she'll say. "Now get on with it, will you? Maybe even ask out that gorgeous agent from the NSA. Though between you and me, she might be a little out of your league." Claire always told it like it was. Though for the record, Valerie Jensen and I did manage to have dinner together when she was in Manhattan before the holidays. We even went back to her hotel afterward. "Your move," she told me. Of course, that was during the game of Scrabble we played in the bar off the lobby. She'd brought the game all the way up from D.C. And of course, she kicked my ass, but good. Her father also taught her poker, she said. "Maybe we'll play after the trial." Which brings us fully up to date. Dobson's trial. And me sitting in the first row waiting my turn. It couldn't come soon enough. The prosecution calls Mr. Trevor Mann. It felt strange to be back in a courtroom after all these years, and even stranger to be taking the witness stand. I'd always been in front asking the questions, not actually sitting in the stand. "Place your left hand on the Bible, raise your right hand." No serum needed here. We were kicking it old school. "Do you solemnly swear or affirm that you will tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?" You better believe it. Now continue listening for an excerpt of James Patterson and Michael Ledwidge's Alert. At 3:23 a.m., the two Supervac trucks turned off their headlights and pulled off the northbound FDR into a junk-strewn abandoned lot beside the Harlem River across from the Bronx. After he put the first truck into park, Tony took a quart of orange Gatorade from the cooler they'd brought, cracked its lid, and commenced gulping. His stubbled face was filthy, and he was sweating exuberantly, had in fact sweated through the back of his heavy coveralls. "Hey, you want some of this, Mr. Joyce?" said Tony, coming up for air. "No, all yours, Tony. Truly, you broke your butt down in the hole. I'm proud of you," Mr. Joyce said. It was true. Tony had some heft on him and could use a few hygiene suggestions, but no one could say he wasn't a worker. He'd been going at it hard for the last 3 hours between the two manholes, really hustling. He'd been Johnny on the spot with the equipment for every task without a word of complaint. They were finally done now, at least with the prep work. It had gone off without a hitch. The truck tanks were empty now, and the manholes were closed. Everything was set up and ready to go. "How's the link?" Mr. Joyce called into the radio he took from his pocket. "Crystal clear," Mr. Beckett in the other truck replied. They'd hacked into the MTA internal subway video feed, and Mr. Beckett was now monitoring the security cameras at every one-line station from Harlem to Inwood. "Okay, I see it," Mr. Beckett said over the radio a second later. "It's pulling out of 157th in the northbound tunnel. There, it's all the way in.
You have the green light, Mr. Joyce.
Mr. Joyce took the cheap disposable cell phone from the left breast pocket of his blue coveralls. It was a Barbie purple slide phone, made by a company called Pantech. A training phone one would buy a suburban girl for her middle school graduation. He turned it on and scrolled to the phone's only pre-programmed number. Theory becomes reality, he thought, as he thumbed the call button. And the two pressure cookers planted in the train tunnel 10 stories beneath Broadway, 20 blocks away, detonated simultaneously. The initial explosion of the pressure cooker bombs, though great, was not that impressive in itself. It wasn't meant to be. It was just the primer, the match to the fuel that the two trucks had been pumping into the air of the tunnel for the last 3 hours. The tunnel was semicircular, 73 feet wide at its base, 20 feet high, and a little less than 4 miles long. Within seconds of the blast, a powerful shockwave raced in both directions along its entire length. There were no people on the subway platform so late, but in both stations the wave ripped apart vendor shacks and MTA tool carts and wooden benches. As the wave hit the south end of the 181st Street station, a 3-ton section of the vaulted tunnel's roof tore free and crashed to the tracks, while up on Broadway, the fantastic force of the blast set off countless car alarms as it threw a half-dozen manhole covers into the air. South of the main blasts, in the tunnel between 157th Street Station and 168th Street, the shockwave smashed head-on into the approaching Bronx-bound 1 train that Mr. Beckett had spotted. The front windshield shattered a millisecond before it tore loose from its moorings, killing the female train driver instantly. As the train derailed, its only 2 passengers, a Manhattan college student couple coming back from a concert, were knocked spinning out of their seats onto the floor of the front car. Bleeding but still alive, they had a split second to look up from the floor of the train through the front window at a rapidly brightening orange glow. It was strangely beautiful, almost like a sunset. Then the barreling 20-foot-high afterburn fireball that was behind the shockwave slammed home, and the air was on fire. Back at the Harlem River shore, Mr. Joyce had to wait 7 minutes before he heard the first call come in on the radio scanner he had tuned to the fire department band. He clicked a pen as he lifted his clipboard. "We did it, Tony," he said, giving the driver a rare grin. "Phase 1 complete." More blue and red emergency lights than I could count were swinging across the steel shutters and Spanish billboards of 181st Street and St. Nicholas Avenue when I pulled up behind a double-parked FDNY SUV that morning around 4:30 a.m. I counted 7 fire trucks, an equal number of police vehicles and ambulances. As I hung my shield around my neck, I saw another truck roar up. Rescue 1, FDNY's version of the Navy SEALs. Holy shit, was this looking bad. I found the pitch-black subway entrance and went downstairs that reeked of smoke. All I could hear were yells and the metallic chirp of first responder radio chatter as I swung my flashlight over the tiled subway walls. The initial report I received from my boss, Miriam, was that some kind of explosion and a subway tunnel fire had occurred. One memory kept popping into my head as I hopped a turnstile toward the sound of radios and yelling. Don't tell me this is 9/11 all over again. I went past a token booth and almost knocked over the white-haired, blue-eyed fire chief, Tommy Cunneth, thumbing something out of his eye. Chief Mike Bennett, Major Case, NYPD. What the hell happened? Massive tunnel explosion of some kind, detective, Cunneth called out in a drill sergeant baritone. 2 stations, 168th Street and here at 181st Street, are completely destroyed. We have the fire almost under control here, but there's colossal structural damage, a large cave-in at the south end of this station. It's like a mine accident down there. We're looking for bodies. Is anybody dead? We don't know. I heard over the horn there was a train that got fried a little south of 168, but everything is just nonsense still at this point. I got 2 engine companies down there working this water line that we had to feed 7 stories down through the elevator shaft. It's an unbelievable disaster. Chief, came a voice from his chest-strapped radio. We got movement. A heartbeat on the monitor. Coming from where? Cunniff yelled back.
up near you in one of the other elevator shafts. Downey, O'Keefe, give me a goddamn halogen,
Cunniff screamed at two firemen behind him. I ran over with the firemen and helped them pry open the door to one of several elevator shafts. When we got the doors open, three huge firemen the size of rugby players appeared out of nowhere and tossed a rope.
Hey, Danny, what the hell are you doing? It's my turn,
said one of them, as the biggest clicked his harness under the rope and lowered himself into the darkness.
Screw you, Brian, the big dude said. You snooze, you lose, bro. I got this. Watch how it's done.
I shook my head. These guys were amazing, tripping over themselves to help. No wonder they called them heroes.
Send down the rig, said the fireman in the shaft a minute later. We got two, a mom and a daughter. They're okay, they're okay.
Everyone started cheering and whistling as a pudgy Hispanic woman, clutching her beautiful preschool-aged daughter, was pulled up out of the shaft into the light.
Okay, good job, everyone. Atta boys,
Cunniff bellowed as EMTs took the mother and child up the stairs.
Now get the F back to work.
An hour later, I was deep underground, 10 blocks south, in full face-breathing apparatus and a Tyvek suit, as I toured the devastation that had been the 168th station, with FBI bomb tech Dan Dunning from the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
This is unbelievable, he said, swinging the beam of his powerful flashlight back and forth over the vaulted ceiling.
Which part?
I said. This was one of the grandest stations of the whole subway system, Mike. See the chandelier medallions next to the cave-in, and the antique sconces and that rubble there? This used to be the station for the New York Highlanders, who went on to become the New York Yankees. A part of history. Now look at it. Gone. Erased.
Could it have been a gas leak?
Not on your life, Dunning said. Gas and electric are surface utilities. These are the deepest stations in the system, 10 stories down. Whatever blew them up was intentionally put here. I can't say for sure yet, but you ask me, these goddamn bastards set off a thermobaric explosion.
A what?
Dunning pulled off his mask and spat something. Thermobaric explosions occur when vapor flammable dust or droplets ignite. They rely on atmospheric oxygen for fuel and produce longer, more devastating shockwaves. As you can see, when they occur in confined spaces, they are catastrophic. They pumped something down here and lit it up. A gasoline mist, maybe, is my guess. Just like in a daisy cutter. I mean, look at this. We hopped down off what was left of a platform and walked over the incinerated tracks toward a blackened train. As crime scene techs took pictures, I could see that one of the train's plastic windows had melted and slid down the side of one of the cars like candle wax. Inside, the driver was burnt pulp. The two other bodies in the front car skeletal and black, like something from a haunted house.
Look at that, Dunning said, pointing his light at a charred sneaker in a corner.
Wow, the shockwave must have knocked them out of their shoes, I said.
Worse, look at the sole of it. It's almost completely ripped off. That's how powerful this bomb was. It separated the sole off a sneaker. Think of the incredible violence that would take.
I shook my head as I thought about it, breathing in the sweet gasoline smell of burn that the respirator couldn't filter out. What is this? And where is it going? 3 hours later, our command post shifted 4 blocks north to the NYPD's new 33rd Precinct building at 170th and Edgecombe Avenue. When I wasn't answering my constantly humming phone, I was busy upstairs in a huge spare muster room, helping a couple dozen precinct uniforms set up a central staging area for what was obviously going to be a massive investigation into the explosion. Everywhere I looked throughout the cavernous space were stressed out, soot-covered MTA engineers, FDNY arson investigators, and FBI, NYPD, and ATF bomb techs talking into phones as they tried to get a grip on the scope of the disaster. The biggest development by far was the discovery of shrapnel in 2 separate sections of the tunnel. Preliminary field reports seemed to indicate that the metal shards were from some sort of pressure cooker bomb placed at the 2 main blast sites. We hadn't released anything to the press as of yet, but it was looking like this was in fact the bombing. A massive and deliberate deadly attack.
At 6:05 a.m., the mayor had made the call and canceled the city's subway service system-wide. It was a huge, huge deal. For the first time since 9/11, 8 million people now had to find a new way to get to and from work and school. A mega meeting at the precinct command post had been called for 9:30. The mayor and commissioner were on their way, as well as head honchos from the city's federal law enforcement agencies and the MTA bosses who ran the subway. I'd managed to get a hold of my first coffee of the morning, and had just declined a third call from some annoyingly persistent New York Times reporter, when I looked up and saw Chief of Detectives Neil Fabretti come through the command post door. I almost didn't recognize him in his stately white-collar uniform. At his heels was a tall, clean-cut white guy in a nice suit whom I didn't recognize. "Detective, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being all over this since this morning," Fabretti said, giving my hand a quick pump. "I already spoke to Miriam. NYPD has the ball on this, and I want you to head up the investigation. The rest of major case is now at your disposal, as well as any and all local precinct investigators as you see fit. How does that sound? You up for it?" "Of course," I said, nodding. "Do you know Lieutenant Bryce Miller? He's the new counterterrorism head over at the NYPD Intelligence Division," Fabretti said, introducing the sleek, dark-haired 30-something cop at his elbow. "Bryce is going to be involved in this thing from the intelligence angle, so I wanted you guys to meet. You're going to be working together hand in glove, okay?" I'd actually heard about Miller, who was supposed to be something of a hotshot. He'd been an FBI agent and Department of Justice lawyer linked closely to the Department of Homeland Security before being hired splashily to show the new mayor's seriousness in fighting the terrorists who seemed to love NYC for all the wrong reasons. "But hand in glove," I thought as I shook Miller's hand. "I was in charge, but I also had a partner or something? How was that supposed to work? And who was to report to whom?" Miller quickly took back his hand as if he didn't want my soot-stained jeans and windbreaker to muss his dapper, streamlined gray suit. "Hercules teams have been deployed to Times Square and Wall Street," Miller said in greeting. "The helicopters are up and there are boats in the water. Just got off the phone with the commissioner. We're going full-court press in Manhattan, river to river." I assumed Miller was talking about the intelligence division's tactical units used to flood an area to show any potential attackers the NYPD's lightning-quick response capability. But weren't such shows of force supposed to be used to prevent attacks? "Now what is this thermobaric bomb stuff I keep hearing?" Miller continued. "That's crazy speculation at this point, isn't it? Something like that would take an incredible amount of technical know-how and meticulous planning. We would expect a blip of chatter activity from surveillance before such a large-scale attack, and my team and my contacts in Washington are reporting exactly nada. Couldn't this just have been a utility screw-up?" "I don't know about any of that, Bryce," I said, eyeing him. "I was actually just with the bomb guys and saw the shrapnel from what looked like pressure cooker bombs in two separate locations." My phone hummed again as I took a black piece of something out of the corner of my eye with a pinky nail. No matter how little anyone wants to say or hear it, this was definitely no accident. We just got hit again.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Truth or Die, written by James Patterson and Howard Rowan. Read by Eduardo Ballerini. Produced and directed by Cheryl Smith. Recorded by Bob Barrito and Matt Longoria. Music by Cheryl Smith. Post-production by Beat Street Productions. Truth or Die is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2015 by James Patterson. Excerpt from Alert copyright 2015 by James Patterson. Audio production copyright 2015 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents
are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.